He was thinking this as he said, "I quite agree. It is a poor and narrow mind that uses speech merely as a tool for practical understandings, whereas the rich and noble require beauty and superfluity in everything, speech as well. For beauty and superfluity are the same thing. How strange it is about words and the dignity of them, that they can lift themselves out of their bald sufficiency to the whole height of their significance. The word superfluous, for instance, often carries with it a contemptuous meaning, yet it can rise to a royal height beyond the reach of contempt, and in itself actually signify the name and nature of beauty. I often think of the mystery of words when I sit alone and amuse my mind with such charming and idle occupation. Thanks to my Lord that he lets me share his thought," answered she. "Your mind is clear, like the lamps you have had lighted for our meeting. If you were not Pharaoh's chamberlain, you might well be one of the learned scribes of the god who walk in the temple courts and ponder words of wisdom." "Very likely," said he, "for a man might be many other things than precisely that which it is his lot to be or to represent. He may often marvel at the absurd play-acting he has to do in his allotted role. He feels stifled in the mask life has put on him, as the priests may at times feel stifled in the mask of the god. Do you agree?"
"Quite."
"Yet perhaps not quite," he said insinuatingly. "Probably women have less understanding of such a feeling, for the Great Mother has granted them a more general sense in respect of their being more women and image of the mother, and less this or that individual woman. For instance, as though you were less bound to be Mut em Enit than I am to be Petipre, because I am conditioned by the sterner father spirit. Do you agree?" "It is so very bright in this hall," said she, with her head bowed, "from the flames that blaze by virtue of your masculine will. Such thoughts, it seems to me, are better pursued by softer light. It would be easier for me in the twilight to consider this matter of being more a woman and image of the mother than just plain Mut em Enit." "Pardon me," he hastened to reply. "It was untactful of me not to adapt our delightfully idle conversation to the light which befits this joyous hour. I will give it a turn more suited to the festal illumination I have seen fit to make. Nothing could be easier. I will pass over the things of the mind and speak of matters of the tangible daylight world. But before I make that easy transition, let me have my pleasure in the pretty mystery which consists in the fact that the world of tangible things is also the intelligible world, for what one can actually grasp with the hand is intelligible to the mind of women, children, and the common folk, whereas the intangible is intelligible only to the sterner mind of the male. The word comprehend is figurative. The word tangible is literal, though the latter may easily become figurative as well. We even say of an easily comprehensible thing that we can actually grasp it with our senses." "Your observations and idle thoughts are most charming, my husband," said she, "and I cannot express the refreshment this connubial conversation gives me. Do not think I am in haste to pass over from the intangible things to the tangible. On the contrary, I would gladly linger with you in the realm of your idle thoughts, and counter them in the measure of my powers as a woman or a child. I had no meaning in my words, save that a less glaring light suits better for the exchange of intimate thoughts." He did not answer at once, being annoyed, but presently, in a chiding tone and shaking his head, "The mistress of the house keeps coming back to the point in which things went not according to her will, but to that of the stronger. That is not quite fine, the less so that it is the way of women to cling to and dissect such occasions. Permit me the suggestion that in this one respect my Amy should try to be more moot the exceptional woman and less the ordinary one. I hear and repent, she murmured. If we were bent on mutual reproach, he continued, giving his irritation further vent, how easily might I express my regret that you come to me at this hour, my friend, clad in so thick a mantle. For surely it is the joy and desire of your friend to follow the lines of your swan-like form through the kind transparency of a linen garment. Woe is me indeed, she said, and drooped her head with a blush. It would be better for me to die rather than learn that I have come before my lord in an unpleasing garb. I swear that I thought to give you special pleasure in this dress, for it is more costly and full of art than most of mine. My sewing-woman, Hetty, worked with sleepless industry to make it, and I shared her care that I might find favor in your eyes. But a care shared is not a care halved. No matter, my dear, he answered. Let it pass. I did not say that I wished to complain, only that I could do it, if you so desired. But I will not take for granted that you do. Let us go on with our idle conversation, as though the question of blame had never crept into it like a false note. For now, I will pass over to the things of the tangible world, and say how I rejoice that my task in life is stamped with the seal of superfluity, and not of need.
I use the word royal to characterize the superfluous, and indeed it is in its right place at court and in the palace Merrimat, as ornament, as form for form's sake, as the elegantly turned phrase with which one greets the god. All these are the affair of the courtier, so that one may say, in a way, that the mask is less stifling than to him who is hemmed in by the objective fact, and stands closer to the feminine, because it is granted him to be less individual. It is true, I am not among those whom Pharaoh summons for advice about boring a well on the road through the desert to the sea, or the erection of a monument, or how many men it takes to wash a load of gold dust out of the mines of the wretched Kush, and it may be that it detracts from my satisfaction, and I am angry with the man Horemheb, who commands the household troops and holds the head office among the executioners, almost without asking my advice, although I bear the title of the office. But always I have overcome these attacks of annoyance. For after all, I am different from Horemheb, as the possessor of the title is different from the necessary but unimportant official who actually holds the fan over Pharaoh when he drives out. People like that are beneath me. For mine it is to stand before Pharaoh at his levee, with the other title-bearers and dignitaries of the court, and repeat the hymn of salutation to the majesty of this god, Thou art like Re, with our adoring voices, and to expend myself in utterly ornamental flourishes, such as, A scale is thy tongue, O Neb-Mat-Re, and thy lips are more just than the little tongue on the scale of Tot. Or extravagant protestations like, Speakest thou to the ocean and sayest, Rise up to the mountain? Lo, the waters come up, even as thou hast spoken. So must I speak in beautiful objectless form, far from the compulsions of ordinary life. For pure form, adornment without purpose, is my honor and my task, as it is the task of royalty to be royal. And all this is an aid to my self-esteem. Splendid and fitting it is, too, she answered, if also the truth be honored and receive support, as is doubtless the case in your words, my husband. Yet it seems to me that the beautiful superfluities of the court and the extravagances at the levee serve to clothe with honor and dread the material cares of the god, such as wells, and buildings and gold mines, for the sake of their importance to the land, and that concern for these things is the most royal thing about royalty. Petitpré again closed his lips and refrained from any answer, playing with the drawstring of his skirt. "I should be untruthful," he said at last with a little sigh, "were I to say that your share in our pleasant conversation is conducted with great tact. I made a skillful transition to the more worldly and material things of life, bringing the subject round to Pharaoh and the court. I expected you to return the ball by asking me some question, such as, for instance, whose earlobe Pharaoh tweaked in token of his favor when we went out of the hall of the canopy after the levee. But instead, you turned aside into observations about such irritating matters as mines and desert wells, about which, truly, my love, you must certainly understand even less than I."
"You are right," she replied, shaking her head over her blunder. "Forgive me. My eagerness to know whose earlobe Pharaoh tweaked today was only too great. I dissembled it by small talk. Pray understand me. I thought to put off the question, feeling that a slow leading up to the important subject is the finest and most important feature of elegant conversation. Only the clumsy blunder in their approach by precipitation, betraying at once the whole content of their minds. But now that you have permitted me the question, was it not yourself, my husband, whom the god distinguished?"
"No," said Petitpré, "it was not I. It often has been, but not today. But your words betrayed, I know not how, yet it appeared as though you inclined to the view that Horemheb, the acting captain of the guard, is greater at court and in the lands than I."
"The gods forbid, my husband, in the name of the Hidden One," she cried in alarm, laying her beringed hand on his knee.
He looked at it as though a bird had alighted there.
"I should need to be weak-minded indeed, past hope of betterment, if for a single moment."
"Your words made it seem so," he asseverated, with a regretful shrug, "though, of course, contrary to any such intent. It was almost as though you would say, what example shall I give? As though, in your mind, a baker of Pharaoh's bakery, who actually bakes the bread for the god and his house, and sticks his head in the oven, is greater than the great overseer of the royal bakery, Pharaoh's chief baker, whose title is Prince of Menphe. Or as though I, who of course take nothing upon myself, were of less importance here in the house than Montcalm, my steward, or even than his youthful mouth, the Syrian Osasif, who oversees the workshops. Those are striking instances."
Moot had shrunk back. "They strike me indeed, so that I quail beneath them," said she. "You see my confusion, and in your great-heartedness will let the punishment rest at that. I see now how I have disarranged our dialogue with my proneness to delay. But gratify my curiosity, which I hope to conceal, and quench it as one quenches blood. Let me hear who it was that received the caress of favor in the throne room today."
"It was Noferrohu, chief of the anointers from the treasury of the king," answered he.
"So it was that prince," she said. "Did they surround him?"
"They did, according to the custom, and congratulated him," he answered. "He is at the moment very much in the forefront of attention. It would be well that he should be seen at the entertainment we purpose giving at the next quarter of the moon. It would add to the luster of the occasion and to that of our house."
"Certainly," she agreed. "You must invite him in a beautiful letter, in which he will take pleasure because of the elegance of the phrases, such as, beloved of his master, or rewarded and distinguished by his lord. And you must send him a present to his house besides, by special messenger. Then it would be most unlikely that Noferrohu would decline."
"I think so, too," said Petitpré. "And the present must be something very choice of course. I will have various things brought before me to choose from, and this evening I will write an invitation which he will really enjoy reading. My child, he went on, I should like this entertainment to be particularly choice, so that it will be talked of in the city, and the report of it reach other distant ones. With some 70 guests, and rich in unguents, flowers, musicians, food, and wine. I have purchased a very good figure of a mummy to be carried about, a good piece, an ell and a half long. I will show it to you beforehand, if you like. The case is gold, the body of ebony, with Celebrate the Joyful Day written on the forehead. Have you heard of the Babylonian dancers?
Which dancers, my husband?
There is a traveling company of foreign dancers in the city. I have had presents sent to them, that they may come to my entertainment. From all that I hear, they are of exotic beauty, and accompany their performance with bells and sounding tambourines. They are said to know some new and striking poses, and to have a strange fire of fury in their eyes as they dance, as well as in their caresses. I promise myself a sensation, and for our party, great success from their presence.
Annie looked down. She seemed to reflect.
Do you intend, she said after a pause, to invite Becknekans, first priest of Amun, to your party? Of course, naturally, he answered. Becknekans? It goes without saying. Why do you ask?
His presence seems important to you.
Why not? Becknekans is a great man.
More important than that of the Babylonian maidens?
What sort of comparisons are these, my love? What choice are you putting before me?
The two are not reconcilable, my husband. I must make it clear to you that you must choose between them. For if the Babylonian maidens dance before Amun's high priest at your feast, it may be that the strange fire of fury in their eyes would not equal that in Becknekans's heart, and that he would rise and summon his servants and leave your house.
Impossible!
Even probable, my friend. He would not suffer the Hidden One to be affronted before his eyes.
By a dance?
By a dance danced by foreign dancers, when, after all, Egypt is full of beauty of this kind, and even sends its dancers abroad.
So much the better may Egypt allow itself the pleasure of the novel and unknown.
That is not Becknekans's view. His objection to what is foreign is very strong.
But I hope that it is your view.
My view is that of my master and friend, said she. For how can that go against the honor of our gods?
The honor of the gods, the honor of the gods, he repeated, shrugging his shoulders. I must confess that my mood and spirit begin to be clouded by our talk, which is quite contrary to the purpose of elegant conversation.
I should be alarmed, she replied, if that were the result of my care for your peace of mind. For how would it stand with that if Becknekans in anger called his servants and left the feast, so that there would be talk of his rebuff in both the lands?
He would not be so petty as to feel offense at an elegant diversion, nor so bold as to offer an indignity to the friend of Pharaoh.
He is great enough that his thoughts travel easily from small affairs to large, and he would give offense to Pharaoh's friend sooner than to Pharaoh, in the sense of a warning to the latter. Amun hates the laxity of foreign ways and the disregard of pious old custom, because it enervates the land and weakens the authority of the kingdom. That is what Amun hates, as we both know. For he wishes the fiber of moral discipline to be strong in the land, as it always has been in Kempt, and to have its children walk in the path of patriotic tradition. But you know as well as I that down there, Mut pointed westward toward the Nile and beyond it to the palace, another sun sense rules, and is lightly favored among Pharaoh's wise men, the sense of On, at the apex of the delta, the mobile sense of Aton Re,
inclined to broadness and conciliation. They call it Aton, with I know not what weakening effect. Must not Becknekens be angered for Amon, if his son in the body favors this laxness, and permits his thinkers and seekers to weaken the marrow of the land by toying with foreign ways? He may not blame Pharaoh, but he will blame him in you, and make demonstration for Amon by raging like a leopard of Egypt when he sees the Babylonian maidens, and will spring up to summon his servants.